thanks very much for coming out for this special lecture. My name's Phil Clark. I'm the convener of Oxford Transitional Justice Research. It's nice to see people come out in their numbers on a Monday evening in Trinity term. It's a real privilege to have Sir Geoffrey Nice with us this evening. Geoffrey, I know, is already very familiar to many of you, especially those of you who work on international criminal law. I should say that Sir Geoffrey's presentation, I guess, comes at a very convenient time for those of us here at OTJR, given that we had a big symposium on Friday looking at particularly the International Criminal Court and the crime of aggression, and asking some questions, I guess, about the future of the International Criminal Court, where it goes from here. And several of the cases that Sir Geoffrey's involved in came up in those discussions on Friday. It was a very peculiar situation where, especially for those of you interested in the case of the Kenyan government before the ICC at the moment, we actually had the council defending the Kenyan government and one of the three judges actually presiding over that case in the room here in Oxford. So we thought it was a good opportunity on the Monday afterwards to get Sir Geoffrey here on his own to talk about a whole range of issues relating to the ICC. I should say that without Jeyun Ostawa, we certainly wouldn't be able to have Sir Geoffrey here. It was Jeyun who was able to bring Sir Geoffrey to speak to us this evening. So I'm going to hand over to Jeyun, who's going to give Sir Geoffrey a proper introduction. Thanks very much.
Well, Phil, you've done a proper introduction already. For me, it only rests to say, first of all, thank you for coming. Dear friends, fellow students, members of faculty, Lady Roberts, thank you for coming here. I think taking into account that a lot of developments taking place as we speak in the field of international criminal law, we definitely have come far away from Nuremberg trials, establishment of ad hoc tribunals, establishment of a permanent court for criminal international criminal justice. To have someone who has been at the forefront of this development is certainly a great privilege for all of us. And it is my pleasure to introduce Sir Geoffrey Nice, who agreed to come to Oxford to speak to us, give us his very unique perspective on the current developments, but also on particular cases he's been involved in. Sir Geoffrey Nice has over 40 or almost 40 years of experience in common law, including international criminal law. He has been involved in the trial of Slobodan Milosevic, where he acted as the prosecutor in that case. Currently, he's involved in a number of very important cases that receive a lot of public attention. Phil already mentioned the Kenyan case, where Sir Geoffrey Nice represents the Kenyan government, but he was also involved in the case around the Sudan situation, in particular the indictment of al-Bashir, where Sir Geoffrey Nice represents a number of citizen groups representing, or groups that are supporting the government. So, great privilege to have you here, and we're all eager to hear your perspective. Thank you.
I left the practice of an ordinary courtroom advocate in 1998 for work in the Yugoslavian tribunal because I thought the work would be interesting. I didn't come from a background of being an academic with extensive understanding of international humanitarian law, any international law, really. I'd not spent years becoming devoted through a non-governmental organization to some concept of the world that either depended on an understanding of the good or the wickedness of human beings. I was simply the citizen lawyer who went off to do an interesting job. And that, I hope, is what I've remained. And there may be, as well as the obvious disadvantages in that, there may actually be some advantages as well. I remain free of the imagination that the concentration of the academic can bring, free of the application of the free research that academics bring to these topics. And I probably lack, to some degree, the enthusiasm and the underlying optimism of those who work in non-governmental organizations and the need that they need to do their work. And I accept, of course, that the enthusiasm, even when unrealistic, is more likely to do good and to bring a change to society than the person who is, to some extent, a dreamer. Those of us who sat in last Friday and listened to Benjamin Ferenc, enthusiastic after however many decades, and in his 10th decade on Earth, can only admire the value of enduring enthusiasm and what it may ultimately bring. That brings me to the first thing, before I look at some specific examples. The first thing that the role of advocate gave me, advocate of these prosecutions and criminal trials, as it was to begin with, now other interests. All of us, I suppose, who are involved in these trials, to some degree meddling in the affairs of others, whether as academics telling them what they should be doing, lawyers trying what they're doing, NGOs trying to change what they do. But in fact, when you examine these conflicts or any, all of us, armchair whatever we may be, grow to appreciate that we crawl over the eggshell of civilization only because it is propped up by the army and the police. Academics, judges, lawyers, NGO officials can pretty well go on indefinite leave without an immediate and serious effect on security. Take the police or the army away for one day and society falls into a different state. And so the first thing that the perspective of the advocate gave me, an advocate brought up in the 60s or university in the 60s, swinging 60s, liberal left wing, hate the army, hate the police. The first thing that it taught me was the truth of Dr. Johnson's observation that every man thinks meanly of himself and has not been a soldier. Inverted, don't our politicians understand that concept? Don't they rather like to find themselves in a flak jacket and sitting on a tank? And let me tell you some of the lessons that I learned that provide my perspective through the cases, because that's a convenient place to start. The first trial I did was of a mid-level Bosnian Croat politician working in or operating in central Bosnia, and in due course to be charged for crimes committed by Bosnian Croats against Muslims. The Bosnian Croats wanting to, there's Bosnia here, and then there's the bit he operated in purple, the Lashva Valley. They wanted to tie the area together and link it up to bits of Croatia, and they wanted to seal the Bosnian Muslims. Now, I think I was thinking about it for the purposes of this address. I think I probably got three or four things that informed me for my future work in these tribunals from that trial. The first thing, which was, I remember the thing that I reflected on when I was asked to do a sort of debrief for the entire tribunal on that case when it was all over. It lasted a couple of years, 2.5 years. And I realised that there were three things that were really important for the prosecution of a criminal, international criminal war crimes trial. And those three things are contemporaneous documents, number one. Because contemporaneous documents give you a reasonably accurate account of what happened, whereas pretty well all human beings will get it wrong. The second thing that is important, critically important, is contemporaneous documents. And the third thing that is important is, well, you now know the answer. That was the first thing that was interesting. The second thing, which was I found interesting, and came from the fact that when you prosecute these cases, you can go talk to almost anybody you like. And they'll all talk to you. It's great. You learn so much. And the offender concerned, first of all, I should tell you that the crimes in the Lashkar Valley involved this quite famous massacre of over 100 people at Almichi. There's the mosque toppled. But the defendant himself was a very young bloke. Oh, there he is, in military uniform. What did I say? Never been in the army. But he took to it a bit like a duck to water. And he's only about 31 or 32 at the time he committed these offences. And he wasn't the figure you would expect to be at the forefront of mass killing. His mum was a paediatrician, I think. His father was quite well connected to President Franjo Tudjman, which is how he got a leg up. And he was the editor of the in-house magazine of the local arms factory. So not the sort of position from which you would expect somebody to emerge at the top of a nasty killing machine, if that's what he did. And it won't surprise you to know that he was the sort of chap, poor fellow, who had the sand kicked in his face, although they don't have sand on the Croatian border, but the equivalent of sand kicked in his face for being not the biggest and boldest of men. And yet, by 1992-93, when he drove through the villages of Kiselyak and Vitez from his eyrie in the woods, people had to get back from the road, go indoors, as the motorcade passed. And so it was with this in mind that I once asked somebody from the intelligentsia of one of those towns, I can't remember which one it was, towns which of course had elections to put people in office. And I said, how did you, and it was a school teacher I can remember, middle-aged school teacher, how did you allow this bloke to have the power that you had to go and withdraw? And he said, well, we always assumed it would be perfectly all right, we'd be able to sort it out when the time came. When the time came, I'm afraid it was too late. And these were towns with functioning democracies of a kind. And of course, the lesson of scholarship in this area shows us that mass crimes are less likely to be committed in countries that are democracies. But what this showed me, just as an ordinary citizen, is that it isn't enough to live in a democracy. You actually have to have your hands on the controls of democracy. You have to take part, because if you don't, even democracies can let you down, and you can find yourself being dealt with by a chap like this. Now, the third thing that I learned about, let me just have another look at him. There he is on trial, looks a bit older there. And I meant to show you this when I was talking about value of documents. Well, you all know what that is. But it's just worth remembering before I move on to another couple of points about Dario Kordic, that was the defendant in this case, that the Nuremberg trials tried 21 people in 9 months, 18 convicted and 11 sentenced to death. A very short period of time, and they did it, of course, because they had all the documents. They didn't actually need live witnesses, but you probably all know that. Let me come to the third point that I learned about, or from, the Dario Kordic case. Does anybody know this chap? Probably not. English people might know him. Lieutenant Colonel Bob Stewart is no stranger to publicity. He quite enjoys it, and you'll hear him on the radio a great deal these days. He's now, I think, MP for Beckham. He came across the massacre at Almichi, and he made a great fuss about it. And it was really as a result of the fuss that he, as a publicist, was able to create that it came to be tried, both in the Dario Kordic case and in the parallel military case, Tihomir Blaskic. And what became absolutely clear to me in this case was that this particular crime, clearly grave enough to be the subject of a trial, was probably selected for trial in the overall process because somebody with publicity pulling power chose to make something of it. And that's something that we may just have in mind as we look forward, before we come to the last thing I'm going to say about the Cordage trial. Have you noticed how, in the selection of both countries to be subject to consideration and within countries who should be subject to consideration, publicity of celebrity plays a part? You probably can't see that. That's Angelina Jolie, I think, in Sudan. And here's what's-his-name in the same place. And you will all know that these are people, celebrities, and there's every reason to thank them for wanting to do more than just appear on the silver screen. But in the same way as Bob Stewart made Amici something that had to be tried, we should at least have in the back of our minds, and it's one of the things I've particularly discovered, that celebrities are actually able to determine who should be tried. Well, you might say there's nothing wrong with that. Why not? They're bad crimes. But just think about it for a minute. If in your national jurisdiction you could have burglars dealt with by caution, or burglars tried, would you be very content with the choice of who should be being tried left to the decisions of celebrities? Or would you rather, if possible, that there was some kind of even process of consideration? So that became clear from this first trial. And I suppose the fourth thing that I learned was that that trial, which was presided over by the late Sir Richard May, a judge here at the Oxford Court for much of his life, was actually one that went very smoothly. Cordage was well represented by aggressive American lawyers in an adversarial setting. The case went on appeal. It was largely affirmed on, or confirmed on appeal. And although I can't be sure of this, the verdict of that trial will probably live in the communities of Kislyak and Vitez and the Lashkar Valley as not necessarily that bad a record of history. Of course there will be people on the Bosnian Croat side who will object to it, but by and large this was a trial which did its job under an experienced judge with well represented defendants. The next trial I did was I fitted in at the same time. Oh, that first period didn't fit it in. The chap who started it, unfortunately, and he was very good at what he was doing, unfortunately had to leave for tragic reasons. And this was the trial of a man who was not a very good self-publicist, for he chose to call himself the Serbian Adolf. not just to the people he was about to kill or terrorise, but also to the court when he answered, "Yes, hello, my name's Goran Jelicic, also known as the Serbian Adolf." There's a picture of him here, and this is Milosevic's birthday party, or I think something like that, before he died. There's Milosevic on the right, and you can see gathered around the table in the detention facility in Scheveningen, you can see all three groups represented, Muslims, Croats, Serbs. There they are again. Does make it seem all a bit silly, doesn't it, really, when you see how they're able to get on over the cooker. But I digress. Now, for those of you who know the territory, Jelicic's crimes were committed here in Brčko. The red bits are the bits that Serbs were dominant in. Here's Serbia itself. And obviously, if you ever wanted to connect bits of Bosnia that could be turned into Republika Srpska, and you wanted to have contiguity of land, you had to take Brčko, although it did not have anything like a Serbian or Serb majority. And it was into this community that Jelicic was introduced with a very short period of recruitment, days or weeks, to commit some really very dreadful killings. We may or may not look at some pictures of his killings, but they're slightly destabilising if we introduce them at this stage. There he is. And there he is on trial, and there he is on trial again, another young man. What I learned from the Jelicic trial, to inform my perspective of these things, was something comparatively new, or at least new to me. Not only did he call himself the Serbian Adolf, but he provided very good evidence against himself. First of all, he was filmed killing people, which was pretty devastating evidence, and he admitted it was him, or photographed. And he also gave answers to the effect that, yes, he did want to kill all these Muslims, not because he disliked them, but because he wanted to kill them. And he wanted there to be so few left that there'd only be enough to do cleaning of the floors and lavatories and things like that. So he provided, or there was provided against him, and he provided against himself evidence that would have made the perfect model trial of the issue. Could somebody way down in the management chain nevertheless be convicted, tried for, and convicted of the crime of genocide? Luis Alba, a very distinguished jurist, indicted him for genocide and also for killings in other ways. He pleaded guilty to the other killings, crimes against humanity, war crimes. He pleaded not guilty to the genocide. Luis Alba decided with the then prosecuting counsel, Terry Bauer, that he should indeed be tried for genocide. But at that stage, Luis Alba was subject to informal, behind-the-scenes pressures from the judges. Would she please not try him for genocide, her decision being that she should, and allow the matter to proceed simply on his pleas of guilty to the other forms of killing? The judges sort of explained that they wanted to reserve their first genocide case to reach a conclusion, and this was the first genocide case to reach a conclusion of sorts, to be for somebody rather more significant. Overlooking the value of this for what it would show about the vulnerability of the low-level person to a case of genocide. Well, the case proceeded, and we reached the end of the prosecution's case, which is a time, the lawyers will know, you can argue on behalf of the defendant, well, enough's enough, there isn't enough evidence for genocide, draw stumps, call it all off, and so on. His counsel recognised that there was indeed enough evidence to go forward, and said as much. So we had a few weeks off waiting for the defence case to start, in the course of which the judges announced they were going to pronounce judgment. We worked out that that meant they were going to have their way, and if Luis Alba wouldn't bend to their will, they'd impose it. Guessing as much, we filed an application saying, hey, this isn't fair. We have a right to be heard on this. The prosecution has a right to present its arguments that the evidence is indeed sufficient. No dice. I don't think they even replied to that. And on the day when judgment was about to be pronounced, I explained that could I please address the court on the basis of the right of a party to be heard, the right of the other side to be heard. Judges came in. I stood up. Sit down. Sit down. Sit down. Well, the poor advocate always has a conflicting duty between his duty to his client and his duty not to get across the court too much. And so I had little choice, I'm afraid, but to sit down. throwing my spectacles onto the table as the only act of advocacy that I can perform. An act now apparently filmed for those seeking to learn how not to do the job. The judges relieved themselves of a completely incomprehensible judgment. And despite having promised that they would allow me to have the floor immediately after they'd given judgment, scuttled out straight away and waited for the eventual determination of sentence. Well, to cut this story short, the following day, one of my colleagues was approached by one of the three judges. The presiding judge was a Frenchman. The other two judges were very nice chaps.
Non-French.
I'm sorry, I didn't say that. But in any event, the other two judges were very nice chaps. And one of them approached my colleague and said, what do you think of our judgment, Jesse? My colleague was a bit embarrassed at being asked by the judge. And he said, the judge went on to say, we thought he was guilty of genocide, but we wanted to keep it for a bigger fish. So it became clear that this court, certainly through this composition of judges, was doing things other than simply responding to the law and the evidence. It had, in this case, a publicity agenda, I suspect. Happily, it is happily, when it went to appeal, the appeals chamber found that indeed there was enough evidence that meant the case should have gone on, although in the event it didn't, that we should have been given the right to argue our side of the case. But they stuck to the original sentence, which is very long, and yes, which is still serving. Now then, where do we go next? I came back to England for a few months and then was asked to go back and prosecute Milosevic by a rather different type of prosecutor from the jurist Louise Arbour, Mrs. Del Ponte, who of course found herself in due course heading one court, where a man called Luis Ocampo heads the prosecution of one court. Luis Ocampo heads the prosecution of another. Each of them has, it may be thought, somewhat similar characteristics. Seeing advantage in publicity, either for themselves or for their cases, and perhaps being more enthusiastic than the English lawyer would think appropriate for allowing political considerations to take a role in what some of us would think are purely legal matters. And certainly throughout my time with Mrs. Del Ponte, it was very difficult to achieve resolution of disagreements between us on several issues. It seems to me that the Milosevic case can provide a number of lessons informing my perspective, which I'll try and hand on to you, in particular areas. First, in relation to evidence, then something about the man himself, but I'll have to deal with them quite swiftly. The first thing was to do with evidence, and it's been a problem that's been hanging around since the trial was over. The best documents in this case, discovered by a truly exceptional researcher on our team, were something called the Supreme Defence Council records. And they covered about a 9-year period. They were stenographically recorded and also tape recorded, although we never got the tapes. And they involved Milosevic, the president of Montenegro and the president of the Rump Republic, sitting in meetings deciding what they were going to do with their armed forces in company with the chiefs of staff and other such people. Pretty important stuff. We found out that they existed. We asked Serbia to provide them. They declined. We were going to the court, and it was quite clear the court would, in due course, order the production of these documents, which Oh, I'll come to that in a second. Before the court ordered the production of these documents, just a week or so before, a deal was struck, entirely contrary to my written advice, between the Office of the Prosecutor and Serbia, whereby certain bits of the documents, and yes, that's it, the best bits, were never going to be, some more of it, and there's were never going to be available to the public. They would be available to the judges and to counsel on both sides, but not to the public. There was no need for that deal. The reasoning of the deal has never been explained. And yet it's a deal that survived not only to deny the people watching this trial of knowledge of what was either done in their name or done to them by the Serb forces controlled from Belgrade, but do you know, when it came to the other court, the International Court of Justice, trying the state case of Bosnia against Serbia for genocide, they chose not to ask for the original documents, but to rely on these. And it's a little hard to see what help they got from the pages on display. This was, clearly, a political decision, in my view, a completely mistaken one, that led to that very unhappy event. Unhappy for the two reasons. One, clearly to be foreseen, namely that the public would never know what was done. But the unforeseen consequence of the International Court of Justice making the very qualified decision it did about Serbia's involvement in genocide, whether with the full documents, and they now are finally available, I think, whether with the full documents the ICJ would have made a different decision, we just don't know. But it's certainly inevitable they would have made some difference to their decision. So that's one point. Why have political negotiations, or whatever you like, in the production of evidence? It should be, I would argue, a strictly legal matter within a defined system of rules. I see that the next point that I'm turning to is something that I also learned from this case. The offences that we charge people with in these international courts are highly detailed, complex, and you can probably pretty well push many or most leaders into some defined criminal act. I think a man called Kirchheimer said these days you can't engage in war without committing a war crime. Pretty well. And it seemed to me that it was much more interesting in Milosevic's case not just to look at what the law itself demanded we prove against him, but to look in much more rough and ready terms what in 10, 20, 30 years' time, if anybody looks back on this trial, would people be able to say, well, whatever else, that was criminal by any standards? And here it was very interesting because Milosevic arrived at court, vilified generally as the butcher of the Balkans. I had no idea what that really meant. A banker and a lawyer. We had a look and couldn't find any criminality in his background. And he made a number of decisions in the late 80s and the early, very early 90s, which, on retrospect, were clearly very ill-advised. Some of them were on the edge, letting the tanks go down to Kosovo and sit outside the parliamentary building, if it was his decision, when they surrendered their semi-autonomy. A bit dodgy. A bit of violence on the streets in Belgrade, but is this the sort of criminality that's going to justify the enormous expenditure of money, time and effort in bringing one man to justice? Was this really clear criminality, however it might have ultimately fallen to be viewed by the judges? And so we searched for what Milosevic may have done as his first criminal act. And probably his first criminal act was in 1990 when he led support to the Serbs in Croatia in their log revolution. Well, that doesn't sound too violent. But we got him. It was the same researcher again who found the material for what he did in 1991. The material was actually a film made several years later of a celebration of a paramilitary group called the Red Berets. And the Red Berets operated generally in this war to destabilize the peace. Milosevic was unwise enough both to go to the ceremony and indeed to be filmed. There he is, not very good picture, here he is here. And in the course of this ceremony, they said, "Mr. President, we thank you for establishing us in May of 1991. And he's caught on the camera saying, caught on the camera microphone saying, "I read your reports." He loathed this evidence, and there's more pictures of it, there he is, shaking hands with a leader, and that sort of thing. He loathed this evidence, because this evidence actually did show that not only he was acting illegally, but he must have known he was. Whatever else political leaders can do and justify saying, he's done it, and I'm not doing it in this country. You cannot establish a paramilitary group to destabilize the peace of what were then other territories, Croatia, Bosnia. So, for me, if I were to come back ever and prosecute another of these cases, as well as looking at the precise definitions of crimes and seeing what you could fit into such a definition, it's really very important to see where a man first clearly goes wrong. Because this man, this banker, lawyer, by the end of the period, not only has found himself involved in Srebrenica as a politician, in the offences in Kosovo which led to his downfall, but, do you all know this, he became a common criminal. In 1990, he had... 2000, he had his former mentor, revived as his political opponent, murdered in cold blood, picked up while jogging on the street. And this showed, perhaps, where he had given up any pretense at legality. Another piece of evidence, which some of you may have seen, pretty distressing evidence, which was significant in another way, was this unpleasant sequence of films. For those of you who are practicing lawyers, it's hard not to be marginally amused by the opening shots of this terrible film. Because this was a film of a group of another paramilitary group called the Scorpions. And it was a long film that they made of their sortie one particular time in 1995. And at the beginning of it, each and every one of them took off his beret, had to face the camera in order to have himself blessed by the priest you can see on the left. So that for a prosecutor, he had mugshots of every member of the group. But if there's anything remotely funny in that, there's nothing remotely funny in what they did, which was to, a long time after Srebrenica actually happened, well, not a long time, some weeks, they found themselves, this group of Scorpions, presented with or bringing some six very young men who they shot and killed. And the distressing film became available to us, and I was able to play an extract of it in cross-examination of the man who you see in front of you, General Obrad Stevanovic, the chief of police, because the Scorpion unit, although operating in Bosnia, was unequivocally driven from Belgrade. So this showed Serbia's involvement in the killings of people from Srebrenica, because those unhappy young men could all be proved by DNA and other evidence to have been part of the 8,000 men and boys who were killed in at Srebrenica, or ultimately killed having been taken captive there. Now, what does... So, this chap, of course, I was able to ask what he knew about this and everything else. Didn't get anywhere, but playing the piece of video that I did led to the whole video being played in Belgrade, with something of a sea change in the approach of the Serbs to whether Srebrenica was a real event or something that was simply made up by the opposition. But here's something that was interesting to me and remains inexplicable. Because of those mugshots we had of each and every member of the group, Serbia itself had no choice but to try the people who were involved, including the leader of that group. But of course our case was not that that group was acting autonomously, it was acting on the basis of direction from above. Serbia made no effort to look up the management chain, neither did the ICTY. And I have no idea why. But these things are important to bear in mind as you wonder whether these tribunals do operate free of influence of an improper kind in the selection of people to be tried and activities to be undertaken. And so this exercise, which had its immediate advantage, was to some degree thwarted. Here's another lesson for all of us. They're all different lessons from the Milosevic trial, and I've tried to pick out the ones that struck me as the most important and informed my perspective. Who knows who Milan Babic was? Apart from Elizabeth. Well now, Milan Babic was a dentist, a religious man, and he operated in Croatia as a surgeon. And on evidence that at that time was sufficient to have him indicted, he was involved for a shortish period of time in serious crimes in Croatia, to some degree under the direction of Milosevic. He was represented by a German lawyer, and the woman on the left there, who was one of the team prosecuting Milosevic with me, persuaded him to confess. And he confessed. And he was contrite. So we called him as a witness. Initially, he gave evidence with a pseudonym and blackened out, but it became so obvious who he was that he gave evidence openly, was, of course, cross-examined and vilified in the local press as a traitor. He was given a rather substantial sentence, despite his cooperation, and sent away. He came back to give evidence again, because we had decided in the OTP that we'd get him to give evidence again and again and again, to be savaged again as a traitor, despite actually being a man of some sensitivity, I dare say, certainly contrite. A man who had done everything that every model of transitional justice could require. He pleaded guilty. He'd acknowledged guilt genuinely. He tried to do whatever he could to set the record straight. And what happened to him? He committed suicide in prison in the middle of his evidence. And I actually find that quite a disturbing event, a very disturbing event, either for the event itself or for the fact that having done all that, he was simply cast aside, forgotten, really, by the tribunal. And when we recognise that what happens in these wars is simply ordinary people frequently find themselves in exceptional circumstances and acting in a way that ordinary people will. Milan Babbage is quite a sobering thought. He did everything that he could to put the record straight, and that was certainly not going to be enough for him. The last thing I think from the Milosevic case, sort of the Milosevic case, but really more generally, and back now to the problems of political influence on these courts. The rules of the tribunal included two rules which were, to some extent, in conflict. There was Rule 70, this rule, you won't be able to read it and you don't need to, which said that if somebody provides sensitive information to the tribunal, the provider, state, NGO, individual, if it provides it under Rule 70, can keep complete control over that information, can decide whether the information which is available to the prosecutor to use for lead purposes, but the provider is able to say if it can ever be turned into evidence. So that if a state, for example, says, well, here's a man who's an informer, you can go and speak to him, and the informer says, well, I can tell you about Mr. X and Mr. Y, you can go off and speak to Mr. X and Mr. Y, but you can never say who the informer was, unless the state says you may. Now, all of us working at the ICTUR, many of us certainly, had contacts with various intelligence organisations for very sensible reasons, that they wanted to help the tribunal and to provide us with information, so they did. And sometimes they provided us with information that was helpful, more often stuff that was neutral, and occasionally they provide us with information that would be favourable to the accused in some way or another, called exculpatory material. There's another rule in the tribunal which says that you have to hand over all exculpatory material to the accused. So here's a problem. An agency or an individual gives you something that they control under Rule 70, and you have a duty to disclose it to the accused under Rule 68. What do you do? Well, for long enough, this tension, which didn't surface very often, was unresolved. We simply didn't know how to deal with it. In England, of course, you have special provision for dealing with this sort of sensitive material, with the judge taking a part. But that couldn't happen in the ICTY, because even the judges weren't to be trusted. So that, for example, one large state providing, I can't possibly name them, but one large state providing confidential material would not want that material ever to be judged upon by a judge coming from another state with differing interests. So, in the Milosevic case, we had a number of bits of material of this kind. And although I nearly achieved resolution by agreement with the provider, there were several bits of material at the end that were both favourable to the accused, but under the control of Rule 70. All of a sudden, and without the equivalent of parliamentary supervision, this unclear conflict, you can't see it from there, of Rule 68, this is the rule that says you have to provide material that's exculpatory to the defendant. They added these 6 words and 2 figures, subject to the provisions of Rule 70. The judges, on their own, nothing the equivalent of parliamentary oversight, simply decided to favour effectively states over individuals. Interestingly enough, the material I had, that had been said by the people who provided it to me, there were about 20 bits, we managed to sort out terms for providing 15 bits, and there were 5 bits outstanding. When the rule came in, they said, oops, sorry, none of it. I don't know if you find that, it depends on your perspective, if you find that disturbing or not. The material in this case was probably utterly insignificant in the overall scheme of things. But either you have legal systems that operate according to rules, or you don't. And this was their way around that particular rule. So those are amongst the things I learned from the Milosevic case. I see that I'm probably running out of time, am I? And I'm just going to make a couple of points. First of all, here's an observation by Speer, which I suppose was very much in the mind of anybody who prosecutes these cases, particularly when these cases are prosecuted by foreigners, people who've never been in the army, never been in a conflict, and they come and they bring external values to those who are in conflict. And it's perhaps really sobering to remember what Speer said. Let me remind you only of the witch hunts of the Middle Ages, the horrors of the French Revolution, or the genocide of the American Indians. In such periods, there are always only a very few who do not succumb. And when it's all over, everyone, horrified, asks, for heaven's sake, how could I? Before I try and decide how to conclude what I'm going to say to you, given that I can't finish the other topics, although I might be able to say something about Sudan and Kenya in question and answer, I always found these two quotations interesting for those of you who are considering what, if any, is the benefit, the function, the purpose of these tribunals. Sir Hartley Shawcross, one of the prosecutors at Nuremberg trial, had a very, in a sense, favourable, optimistic overall view. This tribunal, he said, will provide a contemporaneous touchstone and authoritative and impartial record to which future historians may turn for truth and future politicians for warning. So, in no way did he confine the value of that trial. He thought it could serve all these purposes. Later, Adolf Eichmann was subject to extraordinary rendition by Israel and put on trial in Jerusalem. And as I'm sure very many of you will know, Hannah Arendt wrote a book that is immensely worth reading and rereading for the provocative thoughts it contains. She took an entirely different view, you may think, if this quotation is... Where have I gone? That's not there, is it? I think somewhere else, that's somebody else. There we are. There's Eichmann in Jerusalem, and here's Hannah Arendt's view. The purpose of the trial is to render justice and nothing else. Even the noblest of ulterior motives can only distract from the law's main business, to weigh the charges brought against the accused, to render judgment, and to mete out punishment. If those are two competing views, would any of you nowadays be able to subscribe wholly to one or wholly to the other? Or has it all become much more difficult? I'm quite tempted to ask you to put your hand up. No, I didn't think it was unfair. Let me just go right the way down. Just a couple of other things before I close. You all know who these are? By the way, first of all, how many lawyers are there in this room? Hands up, please. Hands up!
We're not proud.
Now then, this is the Wannsee Conference. You know who the Wannsee Conference is. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 15 people who decided...
January 20th, 1942.
Who decided on the ultimate fate of the Jews, the extermination of the Jews. How many of them were trained as lawyers?
I'm leaving.
A majority. How many of them were ever convicted of offences relating to this meeting, this planning meeting? None. It seems to me that there are a number of questions. Have we got two more minutes? Yeah, all sorts of issues arise for consideration, and it was a great privilege for me to be sufficiently close to this misery of other people was to be able to ask them and to have material upon which I could form tentative views, but never more. And I thought I'd try and identify some of the issues that at least occur to me without really giving you any answers. First of all, does man want to live in peace? Second, do war crime trials retrieve reconciliation? Third, does retribution serve any purpose? And if so, what? In asking that question, I'm not actually being tendentious, and of course I recognise that anybody who's a real victim of really serious crime will hold, and properly and genuinely hold, a different view from any armchair dreamer. But in the overall setting of these huge trials, what purpose does retribution serve? Is it valuable to have ever better records of how it is that humans commit terrible crimes against fellow humans? And I'm inclined to think it is, and that these trials, if they don't achieve anything else, provide immensely valuable records of evidence that inform people of how things happen in the particular circumstances and how they happen generally. Should the individual combatant be held personally accountable when most humans act in a similar way under particular circumstances? Does war create a different morality from the morality that applies in peace? Is it fair to be as selective as inevitably we are about which crimes and which individuals face war crimes? Because you can't try everybody. Is that fair? If it isn't, does it matter? Should lawyers or politicians be the decision makers on whether to try particular war crimes, and following on the points I made earlier, to have a part in the particular decisions about evidence and who to proceed against? And then the role of fame and publicity. But perhaps finally, for this audience, will the development of the law itself change human behaviour in conflict? What does anybody think? Hands up?
Yes.
Yeah. And that's the optimistic view, isn't it? I think I've got one other quote that I always like. I don't know whether it's relevant, and I think it is. But given that you're dealing in all these conflicts, nearly all these conflicts, certainly in Yugoslavia, also in the Sudan, and indeed in Kenya, with we don't need him yet. With groups in conflict with other groups for not very good reasons. Remember that picture of Milosevic sitting down with Jelicic and all the others? When they thought about it, there wasn't much of a reason, was there? They could share his birthday. But nevertheless, the historical grievances of Serbs and Croats and Kosovo Albanians, different tribes in Sudan and so on, do they lend themselves to the wisdom of this as an observation? That as man advances in civilization and small tribes are united into ever larger communities, the simplest reason would tell each individual that he ought to extend his social instincts and sympathies to all members of the same nation, though personally unknown to him. The point once reached is only an artificial barrier to prevent his sympathies extending to men of all nations and races. So that there is, whatever the emotion, whatever the law, there is actually a logical reason why we should progress from where we are to a slightly better territory. And who'd like to tell me who said that?
Geoffrey Nice.
Charles Darwin. Well, I think that's a sufficiently optimistic note on which to end an otherwise rather gloomy topic.